You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, September 3rd, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Matt Taibbi on the sham that is the college loan scandal. Also on the program, more congressional support for an attack on Syria. From last week, the New York Police Department now designating mosques as terrorist organizations. More revelations on the NSA. And in Fukushima, or I should say at Fukushima, a plan to freeze the ground to stop what is and has already been a massive disaster. And the Department of Justice last week says Washington and Colorado can go ahead with their plans to legalize marijuana. All right, folks, back from vacation. A little rusty on the audio cues. Obviously, the major story that's happening now is the fallout from chemical attacks in Syria, conflict where, by most estimates, 100,000 people have already lost their lives. Depending on whose numbers you use, the French or the Americans, upwards of 1,400 people, perhaps 400 of them or more children killed in a chemical attack now 2 weeks ago. There has been obviously over the course of our vacation growing attack in reprisal on Syria from the United States. The British Parliament, of course, last week voted not to support and participate in such attacks. We will get into this more as the show progresses, and tomorrow we'll have someone on to discuss it in a more meaningful way. About 15 minutes ago, John Boehner said that he would support President Obama's call for military action in Syria. Nancy Pelosi has said she will as well. House Majority Leader Eric Cantor has also backed the use of force. In the Senate right now, there are hearings. Hagel and Kerry are testifying front of the Foreign Relations Committee. Obviously, there's a lot of issues to discuss on this point, and we will discuss them as the show progresses. We had Taibbi booked for a while, so an important story as well, and nothing's going to happen in terms of this Syria attack, at least for about a week. Congress returns, goes back into session on the 9th, and the vote is scheduled to take place sometime after the 9th. We don't know exactly when. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Matt Taibbi. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Matt Taibbi on his latest piece. It's showing up in Rolling Stone, the 29th, the issue of the 29th, ripping off young America, the college loan scandal. Matt, how are you?
How's it going, Sam?
It's going pretty good. Obviously, a lot of people are talking about Syria right now, but...
Right.
This college loan issue and the cost and debt that is being incurred by folks who go to college. We've now got over $1 trillion worth of student loans extant, and this is obviously something that's going to have impact on our economy and on the middle class for years and years to come. Let's just go back and sort of track this deal that was made a couple of weeks ago to prevent college loans, or at least the federally offered loans, the interest rate from doubling. Just give us the broad outlines of that so-called deal.
So they had a... they had a deal in place a couple of years ago that would keep student loans at the interest rate for most forms of federally backed student loans at 3.4%. The mechanism that they put in there to try to force Congress to make sure that they came up with a new deal was that if they didn't, by the time the deal expired, the rates would double to 6.8%. They failed to come up with a new deal on time this summer, and so for about a month, student loan rates were officially going to be at 6.8%. But then they came up with this new compromise, which sounds great because it's going to reduce student loan rates this year for people who are entering school. But the Congressional Budget Office, the new plan is actually pegged to market forces. It's pegged to things like Treasury bill rates, and they expect that those will rise over the next 5, 6, 7 years. And the CBO has actually calculated that the government's going to earn just slightly more than just slightly under $1 billion more over 10 years than it would under the old plan that would have doubled rates. So right now they're projecting to earn like $184.7 million over 10 years, and the old plan would have been $184 billion. So it's good for this year, but in 2, 3, 4, 5 years, unless they fix it, it's going to go way back up again.
And I mean, there's two points that we should make here. One is that people should understand that the government is this is a source of revenue for the government. There is no cost associated with these loans, and I want to talk more about why that's the case. But the other sort of more broader point is that this is sort of the how to put this without being profane. This is sort of just the crappy icing on a just a crap laden cake in some respects.
Right. Right.
I just want to, before we get into both those issues, let's just go back to 2010, where there was an initiative by President Obama to essentially take the take the middleman out of this process.
Right. Yeah. They did do that, and it seemed like a great idea at the time, because we had this ridiculous system. You'd have federally backed student loans, but they'd be administered by private companies, private lenders and banks and companies like Sallie Mae. So you'd have private companies that would be basically taking very little risk because they were federally backed loans, but they were making enormous profits on the loans. So Obama seemingly said, hey, you know, if we're going to take the risk on these loans, we might as well just administer them ourselves, and we'll take the savings, you know, all that profit that was going to be made by those private companies, we'll take that money and we'll turn it into new Pell Grants and we'll send more kids to school. And it's a great idea, right? But the funny thing is, you know, they claimed that they were going to save $89 billion over 10 years with that plan. But a couple of years later, if you look at the Congressional Budget Office projection for how much money the state is going to earn on those same kinds of loans, it's twice that, or more than twice that. It's $184 billion. So, yeah, we probably did save some money, but, you know, whether or not we actually put all that money into savings for ordinary people is unclear at this point.
Right. When we say savings, it just means that the government's going to make more profit off of this, and the savings are just not enjoyed in any fashion by the students who are going to college.
Right. I mean, what they have done is that they've made more credit available, but people, you know, this is the is that people confuse credit with aid, right? Like, you know, giving somebody a loan is not giving them money. It's not giving them an education. It's you know, lending them money and telling them they're going to have to pay it back with interest over the course of their lives. So if you take all that savings that you made by cutting out the middleman and you convert it into more credit for young people, that's great on one level, but on another level, it's just another way to generate revenue on the backs of young kids who want to go to school.
I mean, it's interesting because it seems to me that the agenda here is confused in some respects. I mean, and by that, you know, ostensibly this is to provide an opportunity for more people to go to college. But it's a bank shot in many ways, because this loan, I mean, in addition to the fact that it's saddling people with a tremendous amount of debt and taking something that for many years in this country was nearly a right and making it one that is a very costly privilege. And these loans, as they stand, are not typical in the sense that it's more like an indentured servitude. Talk to us about, you know, how the loan that's involved here is different than if I take out a loan to get a car, let's say.
Yeah, pretty much any other kind of debt, you can theoretically, you can declare bankruptcy to discharge if you can't pay. If something happens to you, you know, you become disabled, and you're unable to make the money back, you know, you can get out of that debt. Even gamblers can get away from their gambling debt through bankruptcy. They've obviously made it more complicated since the bankruptcy laws got passed during the Bush years. But for most kinds of debt, in extreme circumstances, you can discharge it through bankruptcy. You can refinance it. There are all kinds of things you can do. With student loans, there's no discharging of the debt through bankruptcy. So when you sign up for this loan, it is an unbreakable relationship. You will have that loan until it is either paid off or until you die. And this is something that most kids don't understand. They just don't get, you know, the people who are taking these loans out, they're 18, 19 years old. They've never engaged in any kind of complex financial transaction before, you know, maybe the Columbia Record Club, but nothing like this, you know. And what they don't realize is that they're getting into a thing where if they start defaulting on their payments, they could end up owing six figures for the rest of their lives. And I talked to a lot of people for the story who, you know, are 40 or 45 or 50 years old and haven't touched the principal on these loans, which they're never, ever going to get rid of, and people have come to accept in almost Zen-like fashion that these loans are sort of part of their life and will be forever. And that's just something that's different about these loans.
So, to look at the silver lining on some level, this is their first financial lesson, right? I mean, this is it's like an intro course. But sadly, it's an incredibly expensive one. Let's talk about the real problem here, is the affordability of college. I mean, it seems to me like, you know, the question of loans, and you make this point, very well in the piece, that, you know, we can talk about the interest rates, but the real problem here is the principal. It seems to me that we have dealt with the issue of the affordability of college and the ability of middle class and lower income people.
Are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
I'm sorry, I just lost you for a second.
We're dealing with the problem or the desire for society to allow lower income and middle income people the opportunity to go to college, which has obviously an important payback down the road.
Right.
But we're dealing with that by, rather than making college less expensive, we're just sort of almost putting a Band-Aid on a bigger problem. And in some respects, it's reflective of the question of medicine in this country. You know, we have spiraling costs, and instead of trying to figure out how to pay for those spiraling costs, we should be dealing with the issues that create this cost.
Right. Yeah. No. And that's actually a really good analogy, because a lot of the same problems are in play here. Yeah, with medicine and education, that you have the key problem is that they can't address the problem of costs without offending the single powerful lobby that lobbies on this issue. So you can't really get at medical costs without taking on insurance companies and doctors and hospital providers, and they don't want to do that. So what do? They created this healthcare plan that didn't address the main problem. It got everybody covered theoretically, but through this Byzantine kind of process that will manage to preserve the profits of those two lobbying groups. In this case, what do you have? You have they could have addressed this by somehow making college more affordable. One of the ways they could have done that is by refusing or by kicking non-performing colleges out of the lending programs. They could have tied lending to performance in some concrete way. In other words, if you're some for-profit school, if you're the University of Online whatever, and you're asking kids to pony up 20 grand a year and none of your graduates end up getting jobs and they can't pay back, well, then those colleges probably shouldn't be getting paid for by federally backed student loans. They should have found some way to control that lending. But that's exactly what they didn't do. They did the opposite of that. They've just made more and more lending available. And what they've what they're doing is they're selling that to the general public as, oh, we're the education-friendly administration because we're making it possible for more and more people to go to school. But all that really is, it's a contracting scam, basically. It's a way to get more, funnel more money to colleges and universities, who are hiring more and more administrators with six-figure salaries and are doing more and more building. And, you know, if you've been to any college campus anywhere lately, you'll see that there's an enormous construction boom going on. You know, they're building hanging gardens and Olympic swimming pools and all this cool stuff. And a lot of that just comes from tuition money that comes from federally backed student loans that again comes from kids who are taking out these massive, essentially mortgage-sized loans at an age when they have no idea what they're doing, and then they're going to end up paying for that for the rest of their lives. And so that's what it is. Instead of controlling costs, they just larded more debt onto a group of people that has no lobby in Washington.
And let's talk about one of the aspects of your story that you really bring to light is that even in the case of default, the government seems to make money.
Right.
And in some instances, depending on which numbers they put out at any given time, they actually may make more than if the loan is actually paid off.
Now, there's a fierce argument about this, and there are some people who are using a technique called fair value accounting to argue that the government is actually not making money off defaults. But if you look at the White House's budget projections, it says that, you know, routinely going back years, that even on defaulted, say, staff, the year 2010, for instance, the government was projecting that it was going to earn 122% returns on defaulted Stafford loans. Like, forget about the people who actually paid back the loans with interest. They were going to, you know, because of all the fees and penalties that are incurred when people don't pay off their loans, because the government has extraordinary collection powers, they're able to find you, they're able to attach your salaries, your disability payments, your income tax returns. If you make money legitimately anywhere, they're going to get it if you owe them money. So they, you know, when you default, you incur all these penalties, and theoretically they're making a profit on it. Now, they dispute that. They say that, you know, when you figure in the cost of hiring private collectors into the equation, they say they're only making 85 or 90% on those loans, but still the projections are over 100%, and it's certainly not close enough. You know, they're certainly not losing enough money to make them lose sleep about giving away loans to kids who might pay back. They're close enough to making a profit on it that they feel confident about lending more money.
And anybody working in a consumer credit division of any banking enterprise, if you told them that their recovery rate on defaulted loans would be 85 or 90%, they'd be incredibly excited.
Oh yeah, no. Anybody who could deliver that credit cards, I mean, that person would be, you know, CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase within 10 minutes. I mean, it's the major banks don't even come close to making that kind of a return. You know, 10%, 15% is a good recovery rate. In some circumstances, it's even lower than that. You know, in the post crash years and in 2008, 2009, you know, it went under 10% for a lot of these consumer credit companies. But the government, again, has extraordinary collection powers that nobody else has. Not only are they able to avail themselves of all the data about where people are, you know, from the IRS, from other agencies, but again, they can attach anything. So if you legitimately have income, they just take it. They don't have to, you know, ask you for it. You don't have to make a decision about whether or not you're going to pay it back. They just take it.
And and when we talk about this, the implications of this are obviously pretty wide. I mean, you cover a lot of these stories of people whose lives as individuals have been just destroyed because they are saddled with this debt, because they end up losing their disability payments. What's the other danger? I mean, systemically speaking, I mean, as we move forward and we have more and more people who start out their lives saddled with this kind of debt, what are the broader implications?
Well, this is to me, it's really similar to what happened in the housing crisis, because so in the housing crisis, you know, but both of these problems, these gigantic piles of debt, these sort of bubbles that are happening right now with student loans and with mortgages, they were both driven by the overavailability of credit. So in the housing crisis, you had the problem was that all these banks had figured out a way to disguise subprime mortgages and sell them as highly rated securities to institutional investors all over the world, you know, the unions, mutual funds, pension plans, whatever. And so they were buying all these mortgages and mortgage-backed securities. They didn't know what they were buying, but because there was such a market for people to buy these mortgages, that allowed banks to have lots of credit available to give to people to buy houses. You know, because there was such a demand for those mortgages, they were able to go out into neighborhoods and basically give mortgages to anybody with a pulse. And so that created this horrible situation where there was suddenly this enormous explosion of subprime debt that expanded very, very rapidly in very similar fashion to the student loan situation, and ultimately it blew, and we had a systemic financial crisis as a result of it. Now, this is a little different because the ultimate problem here is that the government's going to be on the hook for all that money and not private banks. The possibility of mass defaults is clearly there. You clearly have a whole bunch of major employers in private universities and public universities that are dependent upon high tuitions, and if that money were suddenly to dry up because of mass defaults, because people couldn't pay for these loans anymore, then you'd have a serious problem economically all over the country. But the real problem is that this overavailability of credit, the fact that the government keeps cranking out as many loans as they do, is just causing college prices to rise. And they're rising at a ridiculous rate, you know, three or four times the rate of inflation. And that's just unsustainable. It's going to, you know, it's eventually going to create all kinds of economic problems, from people who are saddled with too much debt to people who can't afford to go to college to, you know, again, to the collapse of universities and all sorts of problems.
I want to talk about the drivers of college education, but one of the things before we get there, one of the things that I'm really that I think is really problematic about this is that I don't think there is going to be that type of acute crisis where we have this moment where everyone, you know, because you had it in the real estate market, because at one point you have this real estate bubble that is bound to burst because it was so it was based on, you know, it was so there was no real sort of substance to the value of these homes in the same way that college is important to people's future earnings, and the defaults, it's unlikely they're going to happen, you know, simultaneously, I guess.
Right.
The problem, it
right.
seems to me, is that you're going to have this sort of slow simmer of problems with individuals who are not going to implicate the broader society in as acute a fashion as the real estate bubble bursting. You're just going to have people who are just locked into jobs, unable to pay. This is just one more sort of slow boil, I guess, for the middle class and for lower income people.
Yeah, it, you're going to have 100 million seriously depressed people. It's going to be the consequence of this. I mean, right? I mean, that's kind of what's going to happen. I mean, all these people that I talked to for this story, they get out of school, they immediately have to take whatever job they can because they're immediately staring at having to pay $600 or $800 a month and to pay off their loans, no matter where they went to school. And that rises very quickly if it's not an ordinary college, if it's law school, if it's something like that. And you're stuck paying this enormous bill until you're 50 or 60, in some cases for your entire life. And it's a major factor in people's lives. I mean, I had a half a dozen young women write to me and talk about how they didn't have kids because of this. I had people call me and tell me they went into a life of crime because the government can attach any legitimate income. So the only way, you know, the fastest way to repay something like a law school student, a series of law school loans, is to deal drugs or some or make money that in some way that the government can't keep track of. I had multiple people tell me stories like that. But more than anything, I just had people who were just depressed and just felt weighed down and hopeless. And this is like an entire generation of young people who entered this kind of satanic contract when they were 18 or 19 years old, and they're never going to get out of it. And how that could be good for anybody is for the country in general. I just don't see it.
And you know, I mean, this is, it seems to me, and because I want to talk. I mean, you know, you outline why this should be a problem that both progressives and conservatives agree upon. And I think, you know, and we'll talk about that. But I think, you know, the nub of this is that you have this sort of weighing down on people, and we're still not in any way addressing the central question, which is, as a society, do we think it's in the best interest of having an educated, as educated a population as possible? And none of this addresses this. But talk about that sort of why you see, or how this should be problematic for conservatives and progressives, because this is an interesting question, because I'm not as convinced that the number one driver of inflation in these colleges, I mean, certainly the ever ready pool of money to support the increase in the sort of the gilding, as you call it, of these colleges is a major factor. But the other part of that is that we no longer have sort of the ballast that public universities provided, because they have been cutting back, states have been cutting back on support for public universities, raising the cost of tuition to make up for that money. We have a situation where we sort of sort of quasi-socializing the costs and privatizing the upside again here.
Oh yeah, no, that's exactly, yeah, it's a perfect storm. I mean, it's both things. Instead of having a natural check on costs in the sense that you could always rely upon a relatively cheap state-subsidized education at a state university system, and that in most states in this country was pretty good. But after the crash in 2008, when states started losing revenue left and right, one of the first things that they did is they stopped subsidizing state education. And the colleges made up for it by raising tuition. And, you know, most of those tuitions, or a lot of that tuition money, came from federally backed student loans. So it was indirectly kind of a federal bailout of the state college system, except that it was paid for not by taxpayers, but by young kids taking out loans. So yeah, both things are in play. You know, I think clearly if you had some kind of natural check on prices that way, if you had states providing low cost, upper education, that that really was a good education that allowed people to get jobs and allowed people to leave school with real skills and real knowledge, then you couldn't possibly have all of these for-profit colleges that cost three or four times as much and didn't deliver good educations continuing to exist and driving up prices. That just wouldn't happen. But I just don't think there's a collective belief anymore that it's in the state's best interest to invest in kids and invest in their futures. I just think that that's been kind of left by the wayside as all these states deal with their budget crises. They're not thinking about investing in the future. They're really just thinking about how they're going to get through the next year. You see this kind of behavior, you know, it's the same as when they sell off highways and parking garages. You know what I mean?
Yes.
It's this year thinking as opposed to down the road thinking.
Data points here. Since between 2000 and 2010, the cost of a bachelor's degree at a public university went up 46% in real dollars. The actual spending on students rose only 6%. And also, since 2007, there's been at least 15 states that have cut their state university funding by 30% or more. So basically what we're seeing is states cutting aid, and aid by aid, we're saying actual sort of aid as opposed to loans to their state universities. And the Fed's making up for that money, presumably making up for it by basically offering loans and putting it on the backs of these students. So what seems to be absent, because you talk about how conservatives should be upset with this, and I've had this argument with some libertarians about the loans are distorting the marketplace and are, you know, removing the checks that would exist in a genuine market for college. And I think there's some truth to that. But the real question that everybody seems to be avoiding is, what do we want to do? What should society's role, either manifested through the federal government or through the state government? And it's clear that we can't have this national conversation about it in terms of states. What is society's role in providing as much opportunity for higher education as possible for students? That seems to be completely absent from this conversation, even with those who have said this is who were against this supposed bipartisan deal to sort of curb interest rates.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, there's no talk about what exactly is our plan here? What do we want to do? I think there's a conversation to be had about who should be entitled to a higher education. Should everybody get a higher education? Should we make college like high school, where is it available to everybody? I probably fall more to that side than maybe some others do, but we're not having that discussion. I think what they're trying to do is tiptoe around that discussion by finding ways to get as many people as they can into this current perverted, you know, market distorted system. And I just don't think it's working. You know, not only are we not producing the same kinds of quality education, spending as much on teachers and on educating kids as they are on useless stuff like swimming pools and landscaping and whatever, but we're also not reducing the cost. We're not making it as available to everybody as we could be. We're just not having that conversation. All these policies that we're talking about are just designed to keep the current system going for a few years longer and keep all the lobbyists in Washington happy.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. I mean, did you, in the course of your reporting, did you come across any politicians who were in any way sort of like saying that this is we're not talking about the real problem here. I mean, you know, we should be talking about the principal. Who is going to pay the principal in terms of educating our population?
Well, I mean, you know, Bernie Sanders' people are saying that. I think he's been pretty consistent about that being the main problem, and you know, they're sensible about almost everything that I talk to them about. But I think the bipartisan nature of this, you know, aside from a few people like Bernie, shows you what that most people are. They don't want to deal with taking on this lobby, and they also, I think there's a lot of cynicism here with both parties in realizing that making a whole lot of loans available to kids sounds to young people like it's pro-young people policy. And there's no organized lobby of student-aged voters to tell them otherwise, to tell them that this is actually problematic. So they're taking advantage of a lobbying vacuum in Washington to ram through policies that, you know, actually don't help students all that much in the end. And meanwhile, they're conceding to a very powerful lobby on the other hand. I think that's why you see this bipartisan, sweepingly bipartisan deal go through.
There's just an absence of a sort of a coalesced constituency that's saying that we need to really examine this question as to whether or not we as a society think it's of value, not just to the individuals, but to the future of the society to have a more educated population. I mean, I know you spoke to the guy who founded studentloanjustice.org. Is there any, is there any semblance? I mean, Strike Debt has been talking about this, but again, that's sort of talking about sort of the implications of the loans rather than the question of maybe what we should be doing is taking any of those profits and pouring it back into, some type of federally funded system of state universities.
Right, either that or, you know, there's a plan out in Oregon now that they're thinking about implementing that would essentially they wouldn't incur debt at all when they went to colleges. It would all be funded by the state, and then you would essentially promise a percentage of your future earnings in return. But you wouldn't have the debt hanging over your head when you left. It would be entirely contingent upon how well you did after you got out. There are a number of plans that are kicking around that are like that. That would make sense. But I just don't think we're going to see that. I think, you know, after, you know, a couple of weeks ago when this issue was sort of briefly in the news, after the compromise and then, we had that whole mess with the NSA and Glenn Greenwald's partner being arrested. And then a day later, literally, the president goes on this road tour to announce this new plan that they're going to have to reduce the cost of college that would involve a government-funded rating system to make sure that there was some sort of performance rating for schools that received federally backed tuition dollars. But that plan wouldn't go into effect until 2018 at the earliest. There's plenty of time for that to be derailed. And my guess is that they're going to be able to successfully keep the whole issue under wraps just by holding out the carrot of some kind of, you know, future plan like that, rather than dealing with it immediately in some more concrete fashion.
And I got to say, that whole rating system, I just, you know, there it's one thing to sort of say we're going to weed out sort of the fraudulent schools. But, I mean, how do you actually quantify? I mean, it's the same problem we have with all the corporatization of the so-called school reform movement. How do you measure something like that? I mean, how do you measure the value of having people in society who are well versed with literature or with history? I mean, it seems to me that that's just, you know, we're incentivizing the wrong things when we talk about higher education.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. You know, I can't even imagine what the rating system's parameters would end up being. I mean, they're talking about things like the ability to repay the loan, you know, within X number of years after graduation, income levels, you know, whether how and the number of people who drop out before completing their educations, who complete their degree programs. But this doesn't tell us anything about the value of an education. And I think that's, you're absolutely right. That's going to be lost in all of this is the kind of intangible benefit of education that I think people used to very strongly believe in this country. This whole idea, that's what liberal arts was all about. It didn't teach you to have a particular saleable skill. It just taught you to think and to look at the world a certain way. Because I think they're gonna move more towards quantifiable parameters of ways of measuring the value of education, I think that's going to be lost in the shuffle, and we're going to be moving towards a different kind of model, which is unfortunate. You know, I think it's important for people to be well rounded and to know and to kind of know the history of the world and to be well read. But I don't know what you think, but I think that's...
Agree. I mean, I think, you know, you're losing the value of sort of like of enhancing people as sort of as members of civil society, as citizens, versus being worker drones in some respect. I mean, that's the thing I like about that Oregon plan, and we should say that it passed the state house. I think it's been signed into law. They're going to start. I think it's been signed into law. They're going to start to attempt to implement that over the next couple of years. They need to find, I think, some initial funding for it. I think it's Wyden is, you know, talking about introducing this on a federal level. But that at least, you know, says we're going to take the pressure. If people want to go and become teachers, or if they want to become social workers, or if they want to engage in a profession or a pursuit of work that is going to enhance society, but not necessarily provide them big bucks, then we should help them out in that endeavor, because it makes society better. It's a little bit depressing, but I'm excited about what's going on in Oregon. So let's.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're absolutely right. That's exactly what we're not seeing now. You know, I mean, all these people I talked to for the story, they all said the same thing. It's like I had to take, you know, whatever crappy high paying job I could as quickly as I could, and I had to keep it, you know, no matter what indignities I had to suffer, no matter what awful stuff I had to do to keep the job, I had to, because I had these bills that I had to pay, and I can't default on them. You know, if I default on them, then it's just going to stick to me for the rest of my life. And you know, I think we all remember our 20s, and when you're living off ramen noodles and there's all these horrible decisions that you have to make that are really confusing. If you add that variable of you have to take the highest paying job immediately and stick with it at all costs, what kind of a generation are we going to raise if that's the equation? I think the other plan is much better. I mean, it tells young people that, hey, look, if you want to take this non-traditional route in your career, if you want to do something that's more like volunteer work or more like social work or, you know, politically oriented, whatever it is, you know, we value that too. I think that would be a great thing. You know, it would free up kids to, you know, and young people to not feel this relentless pressure that everybody feels now. I mean, I left the country to get away from this stuff, and I didn't even have student loans. I had to spend my entire 20s out of the United States because I was too afraid of dealing with it. If I had a six-figure debt on top of that, I probably never would have come back.
Well, we're glad you did come back, Matt. and appreciate
you,
your the phone bills to Russia would have just been huge, and we certainly couldn't sustain that here, but I appreciate your coming on today. The piece is in Rolling Stone. We'll link to it at majority.fm. Matt, always a pleasure.
All right. Thanks a lot, Sam. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye. All right, folks, we're going to head into the better half of the program in a moment. Just a reminder, and if you are one of those people who are a beta user of the app, You got a push notification this morning that we were live and back with Matt Taibbi. The app is going to be released sometime in the next 15 days, I believe. You know, it's not totally in our hands. Apple, I think, is looking at it, and I think we have submitted to the Android market as well. And I don't know if they have as draconian, but they need to go. Apple needs to make sure that we're not in any way criticizing them, or I don't think that's the part of the case. But Matt just pricked up there. He's like, what? No,
they're actually making sure probably that we're not, you know, trying to inject your phone with the virus, or that there's any, you know, nude photos of Sam Cedar in there, because Apple is
environment. That's completely redundant. The idea of nude photos of myself or injecting your phone with a virus, exactly the same thing. So, folks, keep tuning in. We're going to send out email blasts to you. If you're on our email list, if you're not, you can sign up at majority.fm. We're going to let you know when the app is coming out. We're even talking maybe about doing a Kickstarter, because I went hog wild on the app expenditures, busting the budget three times over at this point. But it's very exciting. I mean, as I over the vacation, I just noticed it's one more opportunity to notice the value of the app, because when you say you do a podcast, people are like, how can I listen to the show? Well, it's a podcast, and you can just see many people's eyes is sort of glazing over this notion of, like, I'm going to have to go to the computer and download something. People get scared. The app is going to really fundamentally change the way people will listen to the show. You won't have to say to people, it's a podcast. No, it's just, you can listen to it on your phone. It's an app. And it is beautifully constructed. I am convinced, having done a tour of just about every radio show or podcast that has an app, that we have, I think, the best. You can listen live. You can watch it live. You can one-touch I Am the Show. You can one-touch call the show if you listen live. If you don't listen live, you can listen to any of the past 25 shows, if you're a free listener. If you're a member, you can listen at this point to the last 200 shows as easily as you can listen to yesterday's show. And eventually, we will have loaded up all of the deep Majority Report archives. You'll be able to listen to thousands of shows. You'll be able to search that on your phone as easily as you search for an app on your phone. As easily as you search for anything in any part of your life, can't find your keys, easier to find a podcast from 2 years ago on the app. So if you're not on our mailing list, sign up at majority.fm. If you don't want to be on our mailing list, tune into the show. We will tell you the day that it's going to be released. We will give you a couple of days advance notice. We want everybody to download the app on the same day so that it pushes it up, so that it gets some exposure. We're very excited about this. Of course, the best way to support the show is to become a member at majority.fm. You can also, on the app, one touch, you're on the donate page. You can donate from your phone if you have a PayPal account. Even if you don't, I think you can just put in your credit card number. And donate to the show if you want to do a one-off donation. So we're very excited about it. Of course, you can always buy your Amazon crap through our Amazon link at majority.fm. Click on it, bookmark it, always buy your Amazon crap through there. It supports the program. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Get a 10% discount when you use the coupon code MAJORITY. See you all in the better half. We'll be right back.